Pesach Reflections is sponsored by Mrs. Lillian Kahn, Dr. and Mrs. Robert Fruchtman, and Mr. and Mrs. Reuben Kahn, in memory of their beloved husband and father, Mr. Meir Kahn, Olav HaShalom, Reb Meir ben Reuven HaKohen, Tehei Nafshei Tzrura, B'Tzrayer HaChaim.
What we're discussing tonight has been touched upon in previous years, but I think I would like to devote a single session to the topic, and that is the basic format of the manner in which we conduct the Seder. Unlike virtually any other observance or any other holiday, the Pesach Seder demands that we go out of our way to do things that are unusual, that are out of place, different, distinct, whatever. Things that are sufficiently surprising that even small children will be moved to ask questions about, why are you doing that weird thing? We never do that, ever. We don't do it on Shabbos, we don't do it on Yontif, we certainly don't do it during the week. We are trying to provoke questions. And the questions are not only manifest, the centrality of the questioning process, not only manifest by the fact that we do all of these surprising kinds of things, it's also manifest by the fact that the Seder begins with and for ages has revolved around four questions which are asked and which seem to be answered, although in many instances it's not completely clear how they're answered. What's more, much of the Agada, which is supposed to be a narrative that makes things clearer, in many instances seems to muddy the waters. There are all kinds of interpretations and derivations which leave us with our mouths open. Now, how did we get from point A to point C? Where was the B here that connected them? So in something which is supposed to be an answer, it leaves us asking ourselves, why is it so unclear? The significance of the Seder proceeding along the lines of questions and answers is emphasized by the Halacha, which says that we do these things in order that the children may ask, and if the child is not wise enough, then the father teaches him. If someone should not have a child at the Seder, then one spouse should ask the questions. And if a person is, God forbid, alone, then he should ask himself. Even if at the Seder there are Torah scholars who know all the questions and all the answers, they should still ask one another the questions. So if the point is that we're really trying to satisfy someone's ignorance, and for that reason we try to provoke questions so that we can answer them, then what happens about people who end up asking themselves the question? What's the objective there? The person ends up asking himself a question to which he already supposedly knows the answer. Otherwise, for him to ask himself the question would seem to be somewhat ludicrous. So you have a situation in which the halacha of the Seder makes it extremely clear that this business about asking a question is absolutely central to the way in which we conduct a Seder, that it is part of our understanding of what the Seder is all about, and if the Seder is all about the celebration of freedom, then somehow asking these questions is central to the concept of freedom. There's a good deal of time, it seems, spent in the Haggadah about the four sons, each one of which asks a different kind of question, and the son who doesn't ask any questions. There's one child who doesn't ask a question, and here we are told that when he doesn't ask any questions, at Pesach lo, then you should open him up. As it's written, v'yigadu tol davin chabayim ahul eimer, and you shall tell your child on that day, saying, because of this, Hashem has done this to me when I went out of Egypt. It's not a very good translation. Because of these things, referring to, as it indicates later on, I might think that we should begin to tell the story of Pesach from the beginning of the month of Nisan. The Torah tells us it must be on that day. I might think it should be during the day, so the answer is it must be Bavuzeh. Bavuzeh refers to Bishar Shiesh Matzah. You have to have the matzah there, you have to have the bitter herb there. They both have to be in front of you, and then you can point to them and you can say, because of these things did the Almighty perform the miracles of Yetzias Mitzrayim, of the liberation from Egypt. With a child who doesn't know, so tell him. The Haggadah doesn't say tell him. The Haggadah says you open him up. How do you open up a child? We open up a book, we open up a box, we open up the door. How do you open up a child? The wicked son asks a question we don't answer. Wicked son says, what is all this stuff to you? And we set his teeth back and we tell him, if you would have been there, you wouldn't have gone out of Egypt. Because of this, Hashem, what Hashem did, lead to me, not to you. But we don't answer him. And if the wicked son asks a question, we should give him some sort of an answer. When Abraham has his first vision about that prophesizes about the bondage in Egypt. So God says to him, you shall know that your children will be strangers in a land not their own, and they will serve them, they will be enslaved, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. And also the nation that whom they will serve will I judge, and afterwards they will go out with great fortune. Rechush gadol. Now this business about going out with great fortune occupies, it seems to me, rather inordinate amount of significance. It seems to me that for a God who does not have a great deal of respect for materialism, that to make this part of a prophecy seems a little bit out of the ordinary. You want to talk about the fact that they're going to get the Torah, that's okay, but he's really talking about guilt, and he's talking about material fortune. So in what way does that work its way into the prophecy? He tells them they're going to be afflicted, but they're going to go out, and they're going to go out with great fortune. What's more, God is really concerned about it, because when the time comes, he says to Moshe, okay, I'm going to bring another plague on Egypt, and then they're going to send him out. Egypt's going to send him out. Please, he says to Moshe, please, I plead with you, I appeal to you, speak to this nation, and let each man ask his friend and each woman her friend for vessels of silver and vessels of gold. And as we're talking about the time when they actually go out, So it says that the Egyptians, the Pharaoh, came and said, get out of here, you take your sheep and your cattle with you. And the Egyptians hurried them out of the land because they were afraid that they were all going to die. And the nation took their dough before it had a chance to leaven. And so on. And then it says, and the children of Israel did like the word of Moshe, and they asked of Egypt vessels of silver and vessels of gold and raiment. And God gave the favor of the nation in the eyes of the Egyptians, and they gave them what they asked for. And they really emptied Egypt. And our sages are really intrigued by the fact that God has to say to Moshe, please, please, he appeals to them, please speak to them, convince them that they should ask for riches. The Medrash says that this is a parable. One way we could understand this would be, there's a parable of a fellow who's in the dungeon, and he's sick unto death in the dungeon, and somebody comes to him and says to him, tomorrow you'll go out. If you just hang in there till tomorrow, you're gonna leave the dungeon with all kinds of treasures and stuff. And he says to him, do me a favor, keep your treasures, get me out tonight. And that this is some of the case over here, that he has to tell them, please talk to them. Tell them that they should speak to the Egyptians, and they should ask the Egyptians for gold and silver and all kinds of stuff. You know why? Because I promised Abraham that would be the case. And I don't want Abraham to say that I reneged on the promise. I promised Abraham that his descendants were going to go out with a great fortune. So they have to go out. So you have to tell them, they've got to ask. And Jews were just as, the children of Israel would just as soon have not asked. So what's this big deal here? Why make such an ASIC about this whole thing? I have another few questions that I would like to raise, if only so that when the time comes that we can tie them together, that you'll know where they came from. In the description of the shattering of the tablets of the Ten Commandments, so the Chumash describes Moshe coming down from the mountain. He was holding these two tablets of stone, and they were written on both sides. Then it says the Luchais were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God, Chavus al Haluchos. They were engraved in the stone. And the Gemara Neirovin makes a comment about this business about the engraving on the stone. Amar Ravacha bar Yanke, Al Tikri Chavus Elochemus. The word meaning engraved, if you put a different vowel to it, will take on a new meaning. Choros, the words were engraved upon the stone. Read it, the words were cherus al haluchos. They were freedom upon the stone. And were the Jews not to have stumbled with his business with the golden calf, there would have been no nation that could have successfully made them subordinate to them in any extent. That were it not for the fact that the Jews sinned with the golden calf, that the fact that they had this revelation at Sinai with the luchos that had been engraved with words of freedom, that had they not sinned, that they would have been a free people to the point where no nation could have subjugated. One final question. final question is that there is a mitzvah for parents to teach children. And those of you who on occasion recite the Shema know that there are two possibilities for us to derive that mitzvah from. In the first portion of the Shema, which is in Parshas Veschanan, it's written Vishinantam Levanecha, which which means to teach the child, but doesn't mean so much to teach so much as it means, Rashi says, to sharpen it. That the words of Torah must be sharp. They must fall easily. One must be familiar with them to the point where you can respond to any situation with the proper Torah response. That's what Bishinanta means. In the second portion of the Shema, which is derived from the following parsha, we have the chapter of the Shema that begins V'hayoyim Shemaya, and there we have the word V'limadetem Eisem Es Menichem, you shall teach your children. And it basically continues the same way, to speak in these things when you sit in your house, when you travel along the way, when you lie down, when you get up. But that's the end of the pasuk, the end of the verse is exactly the same as in the first chapter. The mitzvah, the codifiers of the mitzvahs tell us, and it's derived from the Gemara, that the mitzvah to teach our children is derived from the words v'limadeta, not from the words v'shinanta. So, the question I pose for you is, why do we skip over an earlier pasuk which implies that one should teach their children in deference to a later pasuk and make that the source of teaching our children? We could just as easily have taken and said that the source of the mitzvah, of the obligation to teach children, is v'shinantam levanech. What's wrong with that? Why do we have to go to v'limadetem? I'd like to share with you an observation which is made by Rav Hutner, Zichroni Livracha, in response to this whole business of the question and answer format. He builds upon the fact that there is something that's called Halal Agob, Great Halal. And in that Great Halal, there are 26 exclamations, each one of which concludes with Halal's praise. Halal Agob, the great praise. And in each one of those 26 exclamations concludes with the words Ki Liolam Chasdo, forever is God's chesed, God's kindness. So our sages tell us that this song of praise, this Halal HaGodol, is built upon the fact that from the beginning of creation until the giving of the Torah, that there were 26 generations which preceded the giving of the Torah. And those 26 generations that were without Torah were dependent upon God's chesed, upon God's kindness. So that, corresponding to each generation, whose survival was dependent upon God's loving kindness, upon God's chesed, we have 26 exclamations, 26 verses, each one which concludes with, Ki Liolam Chasdo, because God's compassion is forever. The implication is very clear that once the Torah was given, that somehow that God's kindness stopped. So Hutner says, of course, that's an impossibility. There's no way in which anybody in their right mind can read that in that fashion. So he says that there are two kinds of kindness. One that we might characterize by the way in which a person responds with another individual who is not very fortunate and who's having a tough time with it. So one way of dealing with it is for the person who is blessed with good fortune to be charitable. And every day the fellow comes to him for a handout, or every week or every month as the case is, and he hands him out, he gives him a handout. That's one form of loving kindness. There's another kind of loving kindness where the fortunate person says to the less fortunate individual, look, let me help you stand on your own two feet. Let me loan you money so that you can start your own business. Or let me teach you a craft so that you can earn for yourself. The second act of these, the second format of these two, appears to be on one level less generous, because in one instance the person was doing everything, when in fact the second format, the second paradigm, is much more generous, because what one has done is to have given a person his own dignity. You've given him the wherewithal to sustain himself so that he does not have to come and subject himself to the indignity of this constant giving, this constant charity. Based on that, Rav Huttner explains, the first 26 generations, when the human race did not have the wherewithal, so to speak, to earn its own keep, there was no direct revelation to the world through which humanity could say, I deserve to be sustained by the way in which I conduct myself. Each generation required its own separate blessing of loving kindness. There were 26 generations, there were 26 emanations of loving kindness, each one of which was different than the other one, depending on how meritorious or how evil the generation was. So God's loving kindness sustained the world. But God's kindness to the world deepened, not lessened, when he reached the point of Matan Torah, that is, of the giving of the Torah, when he said to the world, you know what? From now on, if you're worth it, if you're worth the trouble, then you will earn your keep. And with that, there was a dignity that God imparted to mankind, which is much more profound than anything that preceded it. And there are no more Kili Olam Chasdos, which implies separate emanations depending on what, how much was needed to keep the world going, because now there's one Hanhaga. Basically, there's one way in which the world runs. And we're told every Yom Kippur and every Rosh Hashanah that we better remember that it could be one act of righteousness that will balance the world in favor of being sustained further, if the world should balance out just so. And it could go in either direction. One act of mitzvah, one good deed, could tip the balance so that the world is sustained only because of a little act of thoughtfulness, one godly act. So now we earn our keep. Now that we have the Torah, there's only one hanhaga, there's only one dynamic that sustains all things, and that's if we, as receivers, make ourselves deserving. The Huttner concludes that since it was on Pesach that this whole new dynamic was set into motion, that therefore the manner in which we must show our understanding of the fact that the world all of a sudden now began to shift into a different gear, one in which we had to deserve our keep, is that You don't just simply tell the story, but you try to make the recipient of the story work for the story. You provoke him to ask questions, so that in the asking of the questions, there is some measure of industry on the part of the questioner, so that you can respond to someone who deserves to know. So it's a paradigm. It's a paradigm of a new order, of a new kind of an operation. The world is shifted now into, if you work for it, you'll get it. If you provoke it, you will receive it. Now the fact is that if we really look at the way life runs, that's the way life is. The Almighty did not make infants in such a way that mothers open up the infant's mouth and pour sustenance into the infant's mouth. The infant is born with a sucking reflex. If there is something amiss, then we know that there is something wrong in the organism. If there is a child who does not have that reflex, then there is in fact something that is not, from our perspective of normalcy, there is something that is awry with this child's constitution. Life demands that there be some sort of a demand, some sort of an invitation to live. I wish to be sustained. Therefore, I will initiate the demand for, the need for sustenance. Out of all of the people who lived before Avraham Avinu, there were a great many who must have philosophized about the origin of the world. What was the uniqueness of Avraham? The uniqueness of Avraham, the Midrash tells us as follows. This is to be likened unto a person who happens to be traveling and he sees a palace, Dolekis. Now, Dolekis might mean that there is a light on in the palace, or it appears to be more accurately translated as a palace which is on fire. And the traveler looks at this and says, is it possible that this palace has no owner, that it is abandoned? It's a palace. So the owner of the palace saw the question and he jumps out and says, I'm the owner of the palace. Similarly, Avraham Avinu, there are a great many different accounts of how he proceeded to do this, but Avraham Avinu, patriarch Abraham, questioned the origin of the world. And he wanted to worship the force that governed the world. He looked at a world in which it appeared to be as though the world had been abandoned. And yet he could not deny the fact that the world must have an owner. So he was puzzled about the fact that the palace appeared to be abandoned, that the palace was on fire. This is no way to run a railroad. And he asked the question, is it possible that a world that is so magnificently ordered should have been abandoned? And at that point, the Almighty revealed himself. Avram's uniqueness came in his insistence upon asking the question where other people simply stopped, shrugged their shoulders, and moved on. The beginning of our faith began with someone who was willing to frame a question. It is the framing of the question that tells you about the earnestness and the seriousness of the spectator. The moment, what turns a spectator into a participant, that makes him a part of the process, is the seriousness and the earnestness that leads to what is a legitimate and serious investigation. I insist upon knowing the answer. I'm going to research until I find out the question. If I don't, if I'm an armchair philosopher, or if we need to use an image, if I am a Sesame Street student, then I am not an interactive student. I am being entertained. And the nature of our students today is our students who don't understand interactive learning. They need to be entertained. Our teachers are faulted for not being entertaining enough. And because we are a society of child worshippers, we drive our teachers crazy because they are not entertaining enough. But we have lost the art. As a nation, we have lost the art of interactive learning. So our nationhood begins with a serious question. Life begins with a serious demand for sustenance. And our nationhood, as an elected people, must begin with an interactive process. That is, that we must ask questions in order that we will not be mere spectators to history, but we will be participants in it. Freedom is a very special term, which we have defined before. Freedom, we said, means not license, not anarchy, not the ability to cast oneself in whatever direction one's inclinations at the moment drive them to, but rather Jewish freedom, we have said, is the full potentialization of the individual's, all the individual's promise. Whatever a person can be at their finest, if all of that is liberated so that it is not potential, that it is actual, that person is the freest picture. And that person, and then we use the great many different images, an image with which, the one with which you're most familiar is the violin string. Violin string, which, when it's not tied bound to the violin, is very free. You twist it, it moves, but there's no song. You bind it to the violin, it is bound, but for the first time, it can surrender its song. Torah is a discipline, but its objective is that in the discipline, all of a person's genius becomes gradually liberated. It goes from a state of being dormant, of being latent, of being merely a promise, and it goes into being a vibrant, active muscle in a person's character. A person has become. And the process of living a Torah life is the process of becoming. Were it not for the fact that life was intended so that a person would be responsible for his own becoming, then the world need not have been created. God could have sustained all of the souls that he wanted in his heavenly abode, and God would have given these souls all of their needs, all of their blessings, all of the bliss that he wanted to give them. Instead, God said, that can't be the way it is. because to receive something for nothing has no dignity. If one is to receive and receive with dignity, then one should earn that which they receive. Consequently, you have a life in which there is good, in which there is evil, in which there is temptation, in which a person is driven and drawn. And in the midst of this conflict, we choose. And in the process of choosing, and hopefully choosing appropriately, we become. We liberate that greatness which God has invested within us so that we can become a better, finer, more excellent vessel with which to receive God's goodness. So creation itself, paradigm of creation, demands that becoming is something that we do. The freedom, then, of becoming is directly dependent upon our investment. How much are we putting in? How much are we trying to become? If God would have wanted the world to resemble Sesame Street, then we would not have been born. He could have done the whole business with Big Bird right upstairs. But God did not want us to be entertained in life. Man is born for toil. That's a direct translation of a verse. Life is hard knocks. It means that we have to live, and that we have to face challenges, and we have to make painful choices, and we have to try to make those painful choices as best as we can so that they reflect God's will. And in the process of making those difficult choices, we chisel out of the rock of our being. We chisel holes in the barriers. And the promise that's locked up gets liberated. And that's our freedom. The freedom of being everything that we can be. That's Jewish freedom. The promise or the prophecy that God made with Abraham was where he said to Abraham, I want you to know that when your children go out, they're going to go out with great riches. Now, I can tell you that God is not into gold and silver. Certainly not for the sake of gold and silver. But there's a very important lesson that Jews learned when they did what they did. For over 200 years, they're slaves. The only will that they know is the will of their master. They want what their masters tell them they want. They're happy when their masters tell them they're happy. They're miserable when their taskmasters tell them that they're miserable. Essentially, they have no will of their own. All of a sudden, to this nation that is an afflicted people, Moshe comes along and says to them, go to your master and insist that they give you their most precious things. Who are you talking to? Talking to a nation? First of all, they have no appetite for it. They've never had it. It's not a particular interest. If you want to talk to them, get them out. What's the business about telling them that they must ask for all of this precious goods? There are two lessons here. First of all, Jews worked for 200 years, never got paid. The Egyptians owed them. Those riches belonged to the Jewish people. If somebody has something that belongs to you, and you don't ask for it, then you're an idiot. Then you're an evet. And Eved has something to do with the Hebrew word avad, which means basically to lose. A shaita, I mean, a shaita is a fool, is somebody, an idiot, is somebody who loses what he's given. And an Eved is somebody who can't own any. Mashi kana, Eved kana rabbi, whatever comes into an Eved's hands automatically belongs to his master. Because an Eved has no sense of possession. So if you have something that's yours and you don't claim it, then you're an Eved. If somebody gives you something without asking for it, without your asking for it or demanding it, then you're also an Eved. You have no recognition of your own, of what's coming to you. You don't have the presence of character to say, this is mine. I demand what's mine. The process of going to the Egyptians and saying to them an unheard of thing, an audacious thing for a slave people to say to their former masters or to their masters, give me your golden candelabra, give me your silver, give me your finest raiment, is the recognition of both of those things. A, they have what belongs to you. B, you must ask for it. You will get only what you ask for. And if you don't ask for it, you're not going to get it. And that being free demands both of those recognitions. It's a recognition of what you can ask for and the necessity to ask. A religion in which there is no asking, in which there is no demanding, a religion that comes to you and offers you by whatever means. Heaven, eternity, grace, whatever the thing is. And you don't have to ask for it or solicit it or work for it if there's no industry involved there. Something missing. It's not a religion which is a liberating religion. It's not a religion that has dignity associated. The rechush gadol, the great fortune, is not the material stuff, but the understanding that if you want to be free, that as a prerequisite to freedom, you must recognize that being free means making demands upon that which you have a legitimate right to make a demand upon. And it is that paradigm, that function, that dynamic, which is the story of the Jew and his spirituality. The Jew is a possessor of a great potential, of a unique genius, with which he has been endowed, and it is our responsibility as a free people to demand that which belongs to us. And we must make our demand upon our fortune. So it's not the gold and the silver, but it's this preposterous idea. You know, let us go. What are you hacking us up trying to go bother them for gold and silver? Just release us. And God said, no, you can't be released until you understand that you have to ask for that which is yours. I could do it another way. I could inspire the Egyptians to give you without asking. But then you would not have learned the lesson. The lesson is that you have to go to the Egyptians, you have to say to them, give me. And that unless you say that, that you can't be a free person. A free person demands that you have to be a shoel. The Yishalei, Ishmeis ve'yeov, Ishmeis usa. Man has to go up and he has to ask his Egyptian friend. There would be much left yet to be desired. And in terms of our understanding, what goes on in the Haggadah. What is important in the act of liberation is this thing that we've been talking about how much of our input. The tam, the simple sense, comes along and says, Mazos, what's this? What are you doing? Now, we don't have a great deal of respect for the simple sense, because there's not very much of him in that question. That's a simple question. And a simple question is not the question of someone who's really serious. Someone who's really serious does research. The Chacham asks a very detailed question. I've studied the laws of the Pesach. You know what? There are in the laws of the Pesach, there are Eidos. There are some laws which are testimony. There are some laws which are chukim, which are statutes. There are some laws which are mishpatim. All kinds of diverse things. By the question which one asks, one creates the vessel that holds the knowledge that comes. And it's that very industry that goes into the formation of the question that then becomes the liberating chemistry. The Tam asks a question, the Chacham asks a question. The Chacham is going to receive an answer which is directly related to the vessel that he has created. And because there is much of the Chacham, they say, Shelas Chacham Chafsi Tshuva, the question of a wise person is half of the answer. If a person is really serious about wanting to grow spiritually, then the way in which this will be manifest is not by the fact that they're going to present themselves to somebody and say, teach me, like the convert did to Hillel, and said to me, teach me the whole Torah while I'm standing on one foot. It's not a serious question. A serious questioner is someone who, when they come to ask a question, has thought about the question, has toiled at the question, they've torn their guts out about the question. They come prepared with something that you can pour information into. And what's more, they have provided for a chemistry that when that information comes in contact with the vessel that they've created, that change happens. You can go to people, friends, or you can go to your children, and you can talk to them about whatever you want. You can talk to them about Shabbos, you can talk to them about kosher, you can talk to them about loving kindness, you can talk about 1,001 things that you would hope would inspire them. You are being Sesame Street. You're trying to impact upon them in such a way that they are somehow going to be rived up and are going to, whatever, someday they'll be inspired. But that's not the Jewish paradigm. The Jewish paradigm is that that's not the way real change happens. The Jewish paradigm says you want to teach your kids, you've got to provoke them to ask you questions. You have to do something so that you create a chemistry in which they will seriously want to learn. That's what the Seder is about. The Seder is that model that says to us that the way in which we pass on information from one generation to the next is not by sitting down at the Seder and saying to our kids, okay kids, I want to tell you the story of Pesach. It was the night before Pesach and all through the house. I have to stand on tape. That's not the way it's going to work. If you want the kids to listen, you must provoke their curiosity. You must force them to ask you questions. If they ask you a question, they will be creating a vessel. They will now, they're no longer spectators. They are now participants in this dialogue. You've created something in which there's an interaction. And in that interaction, you can pass on information. That's where liberation is going to happen. Characteristic of the fact that we can only count on being free, that is, on the actualization of our promise, that freedom which is the liberation of our peculiar genius. Our sages come along and tell us that the luchos are not to be understood as though somehow God wrote something on paper, or as we have, do you write ink upon parchment? Ink upon parchment is not interactive. It's two substances that are brought together. Whereas we're told, Esh Das Lomo, that the Torah is white fire upon which God wrote with black fire. That's an interactive process. The two fires are constantly interacting. And our sages tell us that these luchos were chiseled in. In other words, you can only read what's there if you've taken something out of the stone. When you've worked on the stone, when you chiseled something out, then you have writing. And similarly, if we're talking about Jewish freedom is not the kind of a thing that's going to be found simply because there has been a process of somebody teaching us something. Somebody taught us a noble thought. They have written upon, so to speak, the parchment of our person, but that's not interactive and it's not free. It becomes freeing when we have done some work on that which we have learned, when we have framed some questions about that which we have been taught. Either we have been taught because we asked, or because when we started to learn, we were taught that the way in which a Jew learns is to ask questions. And therefore we have asked ourselves questions, and those questions, either we ourselves gained deeper into understanding into what we were originally taught by virtue of our questions, or we asked our questions and our questions gave us further information that we could ask more questions about. But only when we gave of ourselves, only when there was somehow something that came out of the stone, was there an engraving that was liberating in our person. When is there chirus? When is there freedom? When there is chirus, when there is engraving. Writing is not liberating. Education, which is a spectator kind of learning, where somebody tells you this is the way it is, and you absorb it, that's ink on parchment. When there's Jewish learning taking, Jewish learning that demands that no matter what I know, that I probe it. And I probe it because in the infinitude of God's wisdom, there is, whatever I learn, there's more to learn, there's more to know. So I insist upon becoming closer to the Almighty by probing into His wisdom. That act of probing, that industry, that giving of self, that infusion of self, is something that, in which I call out of my being, and it's that calling out of my being which is no longer a static process, but which is now an interactive process. He is engraving in my person that act of giving of myself is what makes freedom possible. And that's the reason that the Haggadah is not a clear answer. It's not a clear answer because we don't want to entertain our children. They've asked a question, and we're going to answer them. But we're going to answer them in such a way that they must ask us another question. What is that? We want to give them answers that will force them to ask us more questions. They say that the Jews always answer questions with a question. But that's really part of what we're all about. I once made this into a new principle. You know that you never ask a question that you don't want to hear the answer to. I said that for Jews it should be never ask a question that you don't want to hear the question. Never ask a question that you don't want to hear the question to. Because real Jewish learning is not an entertainment sport. It is an ongoing process, a deepening process, an interactive process of someone who understands that the way in which to learn is one of giving of self, of involving of self, so that there is a serious interest created. It is that interest that forms the vessel in which we are going to learn and in which we are going to be liberated. So when we're dealing in the Seder with this format of Shiloh and Tshuva, even if there is no kid there at the Seder, even the kids are making their own Seder, whatever the case may be, even if a person is sitting at the Seder alone, God, or if there are two scholars there and they know the answer, they must ask the questions. Because in asking the questions, they are going to ask new questions and they're going to come up with new answers. It's a never-ending process. And that's what Jewish liberation is about. Jewish liberation is this rechush kodom, the knowledge that a nation cannot be free until they demand what is theirs, and that they don't wait for it to come to them. That they must handle it more thoroughly. That they invest themselves in looking for answers to themselves and to life. The more rapid, the more intense, the more forceful will be the kinds of changes that will take place. The words to learn and to teach are virtually the same. In fact, there's one letter that captures it all. There's the letter Lamed. The letter Lamed means, depending on how you set the vowels, Lomed, Lamed, to learn, to teach. And the letter Lamed is also the letter of becoming. You're supposed to tell a person when they take a trip, you say to them, go to peace. Le shalom. You don't say lech bishalom, because that implies whatever they are, they are. If you tell them le something, that lamed implies going towards something. It is the lamed is the letter of learning and the letter of becoming. In Isis de Rabbi Akiva, which is a very early work on the letters, it says that the word, the letter Lamed, which is pronounced Lamed, and which is spelled Lamed Mem Dalet, is an acronym for Lev Mevin Das, the heart that understands knowledge. And the Lamed is, along with the Beis, are the two central letters of the Torah. The Torah ends with a Lamed. And the Torah begins with a Beis, making up the word Lev, the heart. The heart of Torah begins with the concept of becoming. The concept that you must become, and you become through a process in which you are Lomed, in which you learn, and in the process of questioning what you learn, you teach yourself some new information, and you become something more. So you become a Lomed and a Lamed. There's a child who doesn't know how to ask. You can't just talk to him. That would contravene the whole paradigm of the Seder. At Pesachlo, you must force him to become involved in the process. Open him up. Provoke him. Start dipping vegetables in salt water. Do weird things. Open him up. Make him ask you, Dad, have you gone crazy? The minute that he asks you the questions, the process has begun. You have to provoke him at Pesachlo. Do something to open him up. If you don't open him up, if the Haggadah had said, Shani Yadir Elisha, this child does not ask, Vigadatam, just tell him. Missed the point. Then we turned him into Sesame Street. And that's not the story of freedom. It's not the story of Jewish freedom. The story of Jewish Benu is not Pesachu. You have to open them up. You have to help them ask the questions. And I think one of the things that has somehow passed us by is that we saw our role as parents, and somehow in the concept of Vishinantam, kids are going to come home from school and we will practice with them what they learn so that they become sharp. And the Torah comes along and says, you know what, that's not your mitzvah. Your mitzvah is not the mitzvah of making the kids sharp. What you must do as a parent is teach your child how to learn. You must give them the paradigm of interactive learning. Don't allow them to become spectators. Make it such that from your earliest moments with the child, that the thing that you're doing with the child is teaching them how to ask questions, how to study, how to yearn for knowledge, and to reward curiosity. Hide an afikoman, you find it, you'll get some. It's got to be the Seder's hide and go seek. And it's not an accident that this is going to... I mean, what are we teaching our children? Blackmail, extortion, that's what it's all about? You know, if you don't give me such and such, I won't give you back the afikoman. The idea is not that at all. The idea is I've hit an afikoman, and if you find it, I'll reward you. In the process of looking and toiling and seeking, there's going to be a reward. And this is the kind of thing that is the real parental responsibility. The real parental responsibility is the limadit, then use the lamed. The lamed is learn, teach, interact. Leiv meivin das. I must somehow create within the child not the volume of information, but the thirst to learn, the instruments with which to seek knowledge. That's what my responsibility is. I have to give them the lamed. I have to create within them the lamed. Vishinantam. It's also a good thing. I mean, I should do that. But that's not where the mitzvah is. The mitzvah is v'nigmadetem v'nigmadetem. So our sages skip over the Vishinantam. It comes much earlier. They skip it over. They say Vishinantam is not where it's at. Where it's really at is you must teach your children how to learn. And that we must somehow do from the very earliest moments of our children's lives. And the Seder tries to get us involved by telling us that this whole thing, Jewish freedom, the celebration of Jewish freedom, revolves around the art of asking questions, of asking serious questions. The more serious, the more detailed, the more involved that a person makes himself in the question, the better the response will be. And when somebody asks us a question which is not a question, then we don't answer it. When the wicked son comes and asks us a question, which is not a question, then you can't fill him. No, it's not telling you don't answer. What the Haggadah is telling us, it won't help you to answer. Because you can only fill a cup when there's a cup there. If somebody comes up and says, give me a drink of water, and doesn't give you a cup, what do you got to pour it into? So the Haggadah says, so tell him. If he would have been in Egypt, he couldn't have gone free, because Egypt demanded that somebody ask a question. Not this. The Baal HaGod is not trying to be mean, not trying to be vindictive. What he's saying is that the wicked son came up and did not ask a question. He was making sport of you. He said, what is all this to you? But it's not a question. It was an act of scoffing. If it's an act of scoffing, then there's no vessel. If there's no vessel, then you can talk yourself blue in the face and nothing will go in. So why even try? So it's a very serious format. And a format that we would do well not to minimize, but to appreciate the fact that the Haggadah has given us over here a model. And it's a model for life. It's a model for Jewish freedom. It's a model which says that Judaism revolves around the principle, what you put in is what you're going to get out. And if you create an ongoing interaction with your Judaism, one that says, I want to learn from my Judaism, one that says, I wish to probe my Judaism, one that says, I know that I'm only going to be able to hold, not only to hold, but to be liberated to the extent that I bring something to whatever I'm doing. It's only in that chemistry, in that process, that we are going to seriously become the nation that will be deserving of the title of free people. And it's in the process of becoming excellent in this kind of thing that the real business about meeting the generations and transmitting to the generations goes on. The Haggadah and everything that we do on the Seder night is really a lesson plan that says, look, you want to get your kids to appreciate the same things that you do, to respect the same things that you do, to be able to continue this process of human actualization, of Jewish actualization, then your interaction with them must be one where you teach them that the better they ask, the more they invest themselves in their curiosity, the closer you will be to them. I'm talking about, I mean, we love our kids, but we need to be able to show our kids what is important to us. And if we are there for them when they are doing the kinds of things so that we can reinforce their inquisitiveness, or that we can help them become inquisitive in the right way, if we can reinforce those habits, then we are fulfilling the mitzvah of limadatim, and then we are helping our children begin their way to Jewish freedom. The four sons tell us that a simple son gets a simple answer, and the Chacham gets a good answer, or more detailed answer. And that it's our objective that we have to try to create of our children, Chachamim, by doing the kinds of things that will enable them to understand that we're interested in provoking, we're interested in stimulating, we're interested in giving all kinds of things so that they will become part of the process. We don't want them to become indolent learners. We don't want them to become armchair learners. We want them to become involved learners. We want them to become provoked learners. We want them to come to us in such a way that they force us to think so that we can enable them to grow. And that's basically the success of any Seder, and it's the success of a Seder that never ends. It's the success of a Seder that goes on from one year to the next.
You too can sponsor a cassette to honor or memorialize someone you love and respect. For more information or to purchase additional cassettes, please call 1-800-878-5000.